Thanks, Nicole. And what on earth does that have to do with dating? We'll find out in due course. I want to begin. It's quite strange. It's the first time I think my wife, Nikki, has been along to a citywide gathering. But welcome along, Nikki, and I hope you have a good night. It's strange that Nikki's here tonight because I want to begin by actually sharing a little bit of our story of how we met and how we began dating. And in some ways, I'm sharing that story just as an opportunity for you to get to know us a little more. In some ways, it's in part to show that the principles and the wisdom and the big how-to, the last thing I want to come across as is being some kind of expert saying here are the seven steps to perfection and that it's all easy and simple and neat and tidy. Human life is not all easy, simple, neat and tidy. And even in teaching about wisdom and the right way to do things, sometimes, you know, we're not necessarily as wise as we might be supposed to be. And sometimes we might not necessarily do things the good way. And we're each individuals. We each are, you know, on this mad, crazy ride called life. And so here's the ride that Nikki and I have been on. And I've written it down just so that anyway, here we go. So Nikki and I first met before either of us were Christians. So I didn't come from a Christian family, neither did Nikki, and both of us were pretty wild teenagers. And the way we first met was that I used to smoke pot with her boyfriend at the time. And so once when I was catching up with him, Nikki was with him, and so that's how we first met. We were also kind of in similar circles. Nikki's a little younger than me, and so she was friends with the kid brothers and sisters of some of my friends. And so we just hang out on opposite sides of Franklin Square, you know. And so we knew each other in sort of being in similar circles. Nikki's 4 years younger than I am. Then at the time I became a Christian in late high school. So in grade 12, I went from being an atheist to becoming a Christian through doing the Scripture Under Scrutiny courses, actually, with Jill's mum, actually. And I became a Christian. And it was a time when actually a whole kind of domino effect of friends, some from church backgrounds, many not from church backgrounds, became Christians through Elizabeth College, Rosny College, Hobart College and UTAS. And a whole bunch of us were becoming Christians and tramping our way and waking Jill and her sisters up when they were sort of 2 years old and doing these Bible studies and inviting people to church and finding out about God. And Nikki's sisters became Christians. She still wasn't a Christian. And they were heading off to St. John's Presbyterian Church, where we all went to church. And once they were giving Nikki a lift home from somewhere and said to her, look, you can either stay in the car or come to church, you know. And so Nikki said, I'll come to church. I was ushering that week, and I said something awesome and cool like, hey, or something. And, hey, I know some of your friends and that kind of thing. And so she came to church and sat through the sermon. I think she's told me since that you're sort of sitting up the back kind of swearing under your breath and that kind of thing. But then after the service, I went and chatted with her again, and there's a little alleyway, you know, at the side of St. John's Presbyterian where you go to smoke if you're the crazy people who go to church and smoke in the alley. So we went and had a cigarette together in the alley and then got to know one another and went off and had coffee at coffee shop that doesn't exist, well, it's got a different name now, it used to be called Mummies, and so we went there and had a coffee and got to know one another and then walked down to Maryville Esplanade and kept talking. It was a really lovely night and just sharing a bit about our lives. And I remember, again, you don't know with hindsight whether things are more romantic than they were at the time, but I remember one comment I think you made, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Nikki said something along the lines of, some people think that there are multiple universes out there, in which case that's a multiverse, a song. I thought that was quite nice. Did you actually say that? I remember you saying that. You probably don't. Yeah, who knows? So, it's a nice line. Let's say you said it. It's good, isn't it? We'll put that in the movie, right? You know. And then we went back to my dad's place, watched a movie, and I think like my brother, my sister, and my dad, and generations long, I fell asleep halfway through. So anyway, that's how we first met and got to know one another. I think hit it off in terms of just shared similar sense of humour, similar imagination, similar music taste, similar kind of lots of things. I think we just really clicked. However, I was really wanting to be honourable as best I could and not, first of all, not be dating a non-Christian and secondly, not thinking that I would be wanting to be the only person, if I'm interested in her, also the only person sharing the gospel with her. And so I tried to introduce her to my friendship circle, all these people who become Christians. Some of these were were female friends, some of these were male friends, some of these were sort of more our age, some a bit older. In particular, my older brother, I've got a brother 2 years older who's also a pastor, and he and his mates, Christian mates, all kind of adopted Nikki a little bit like a kind of a adopted sister, and so they would give her lifts places and look after her and be kind of affectionately bemused at the mix of kind of feisty, ferocious hippie chick who'd walk around barefoot at midnight, but also protective and care for you, and that was a really nice a nice relationship, I think, and an important part of the Christian community to her. Now, as we stand here now and we're married and that's all worked, and looking back, it's obvious that we really liked each other from that first meeting at church, right? But like what is often the case is, and maybe some of you are going through this right now, you know, you like somebody, they like you, all your friends know that you like each other, but you know, you're too nervous to admit it and all that kind of stuff. Neither of us were probably too confident to realise that, and we spent a lot of time getting to know each other, talking, lending one another music and mixtapes, cassettes, all that kind of stuff. And as well as talking about the Bible, as well as studying the Bible and getting involved in church and getting to know each other's non-Christian friends and all that kind of stuff. Welcome along, guys. There were a couple of times I can remember that were especially welcome along. When I remember we were getting to know one another, when we had especially awkward, anyone watching on could see we obviously liked each other moments, that because we didn't define the relationship, a key theme of the sermon tonight, DTR, define the relationship, because we didn't do that, it was just agonisingly, heart-wrenchingly infuriating. So one I remember, again I remember, it might be less romantic as at the time, but this is, I look back and it was really special. We went up with some friends up the mountain, and the mountain can be great in winter when it's cold and foggy and it's like you're in another world, right? And we're up there with some friends and we wandered out along to look over the kind of the west ridge of the mountain, looking out over to the, you know, the back of the mountain. And it was just like you could only see a bit in front of you. It was all like in the clouds. And we sat on a rock together and shared, you know, sort of cuddled together in my jacket. But we were just friends and, you know, I don't even know if she likes me, you know. So that was a beautiful, you know, moment. Looking back, obviously, Mike. Even more obvious, once down at Salamanca, Nikki kissed me. And I thought that was terrific, and she obviously thought that was terrific. A day later, I try and define the relationship in awkward, sort of first-year uni student manner, and said, I put the hard thing onto her, and so I said, look, about the other day, do you like me? In other words, I wasn't game to say, I like you, that was good, can we do that again? Instead, I just said, do you like me? She awkwardly thought that that was me mildly rebuking her and saying, hey, I'm not interested, you know, phew, let's... So she said, no. So I don't say I like her. I just ask her in this nervous way that probably whenever I'm nervous or thoughtful or anything, basically my eyebrows of death make me look like, you know, I'm about to sort of kind of do a Mortal Kombat fatality move. And so I said, you know, nervously, eyebrows of death, said, do you like me? And she goes, whoa, no. We both walk away miserable. And I remember kind of reciting to myself James chapter 1, in all kinds of trial, consider it pure joy. We were studying it at church at the moment. I'd actually even put it to music. I'd put it to the music of a Nirvana song. And so I was sort of singing Nirvana, except with the Epistle of James lyrics. And this went on for a long, long time. It was an agony thing, right? It was a lot later that we talked again. And this time I was brave, but this time I was a particular brand of overzealous young Christian who didn't believe in dating. Dating was a worldly thing. If you know, if you meant business, you'd get married. So rather than saying, I like you, would you like to go out for a coffee and get to know each other more in a relationship way or something like this, I said, hey, when you're older, do you want to get married? So there you go. There's the script. And she said yes. So it wasn't that bad. However, because I was in this kind of there's no such thing as dating universe, poor old Nikki was stuck for several weeks, months, I don't know, kind of going, so what are we now then? Friends who are going to get married later? Or what? And so it took my now sister-in-law, my brother's girlfriend at the time, or fiancé at the time, it took her, she's a feisty Greek girl, right? So she is basically always keeps me in line. She had to go, Michael, you know, you just can't do this. You know, Nikki had gone around there and said, this is driving me nuts. And so I got told off by my sister-in-law, as will continue until Jesus returns, and told me that that's not the way it worked. We had to have some kind of actually defined relationship, define the relationship again. We had to be clear how we were actually going to work out this boyfriend and girlfriend thing until we get married one day. So is that a rule book on how to conduct a dating relationship? I think we broke plenty of rules in the book, and I think I'm about to make myself a hypocrite by sharing some of the advice I share. But looking back, a lot of our advice that I'll be giving tonight is how things would have been less painful and confusing, you know? How things would have been easier and saved a lot less nervous energy worrying and wondering and a lot more energy just enjoying that sort of phase of life. And so part of it is here's the lessons learned and lessons we've learned sometimes by not doing things the way we could. But the other side of it is underlying all of this, as I said to begin with, we're wanting to share that in the end, wisdom is part of the scriptures. We have Proverbs in scripture. There's time for wisdom, but God works it out in the end. God's good. God looks after you. And even if you do make a mess of things in all sorts of ways, if you trust him and you love each other, you kind of fumble through. So there you have it. There's our story. And now let's begin the sermon building off that. Last time we looked at the big thinking about who you should date and how you ask them. They were the big things we looked at last time. Who you should date and how you ask them. And if you missed that, well, that was great fun to do. You can get that off ufcutas.org and give that a listen, and you can find all about biblical and then some wisdom advice on who to date and how you ask them and how you find someone and how you show you're interested and how you say you're not interested if someone asks you out and all these sorts of things. Today, we're looking at two headings. Why date? What's the purpose of dating? Why date? And what do you do while you're dating? Why date? So what's the purpose of it? And then what do you do? What, given that purpose, what do you do while you're dating? And all of this is building, in terms of the kind of wisdom and practical stuff, it's building on the whole semester's teaching, because how you live your life is built on what things are and what they're for. And we've spent the whole semester talking about life and relationships and romantic relationships and asking the question, who are people, what is life, what is marriage, and what's it for? So it's building off the back of that and then seeing how that Christian view of life, relationships, and romance, how it cashes out in dating. Why date? Here we go. Why date? Coming out of the whole series, building on God's plan for the world, God's vision for marriage, God's reason for relationships. Marriage is a public union. That is, it's a forming a new public agreement, a family. It's a public union. A man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife. It's a public thing. It's not just a private thing. Marriage is public. Marriage is a sexual union. It's the place where sex is properly enjoyed, rightly enjoyed, wonderfully enjoyed. It's between a man and a woman. Public sexual union between a man and a woman that is exclusive and lifelong, and it's for intimacy, children, and the good of society. That's the big picture of how the Bible sees marriage, and we can unpack that in the sermons over this semester. How does dating fit into that? Well, dating is, first of all, for marriage. Dating has an arrow built into it. It is for preparation for deciding about marriage. Now, whatever exactly we want to call dating in high school, that's not what we're talking about tonight. Talking to people in their very late teens and in their 20s, you are too old for high school. You are too old for monkey bars and numbers, sums to work out whether the numbers in your name mean that you know, you're a good match. And you're too old for sort of sending messages to one another, written in texter and each other's pigeonholes in the classroom, and that's about it. You're too old for just talking on the phone for really, really long periods of time, for ages and ages and ages, and that's how you date. You're not high school dating. You are adults. You are young men and women. Your adult lives have begun. And so your relationships now are the kind of dating we're talking about, that we must talk about, that you must think about, is it's for marriage. I'm not saying that you do what I did and sort of say on the first thing, you know, straight after this thing, you just walk up to someone and go, "Want to get married?" Yeah. I'm not saying you have to kind of be all intense about it on the first, you know, kind of encounter or something. But that's in your mind. That's where you're headed. That's what you're thinking. That's the purpose of it, right? You're adults. It's time for adult relationships. You are making adult decisions. You face adult temptations. Oh, I don't like the stuff about dating before marriage. What do you think about that sermon? I think Mike is a bit, you know, a bit sort of prudish or something. Dating's for marriage, stupid. No one believes that, do they? However, in your not about marriage dating relationship, you're facing adult sexual temptation, aren't you? That's adult stuff. That stuff makes babies and nappies and other adults. The temptations you're facing in life, that you're allowed to drive a car. You drive a huge metallic machine of death. You're an adult. You face adult temptations. You're making adult decisions. Your relationships are adult issues. Dating is to consider, not necessarily immediately, but it's entering into a relationship whose purpose is ultimately to consider marriage. And if you're not ready to consider marriage, you're not ready to date. Okay? Get ready to consider marriage, or work out whether you ever want to get married, or figure out that first before you start messing with someone else's time and someone else's heart and someone else's life. Sort that out. Then think about dating. But as a young man, as a young woman, as an adult, if you're not ready to think about marriage, then you're not ready to talk about dating. Buy a PlayStation. If you're not ready to consider marriage, and you're dating someone already, they're probably thinking you're going to ask them. And if that's out of the question. If you marry them, no, we're just... You know, this is just, while we're at uni, we're enjoying each other's company. That's not fair. That's unkind. You should break up with them. You should call it for what it is. If that's not on the agenda at all, be kind and finish it. Some Christians talk about courtship or courting, which to my mind seems quite quaint and a little bit of an odd word. It makes me think a little bit of kind of, you know, sort of knickerbocker socks and loops and things. But who cares about the word you use? The concept of courting is a brilliant one. Because what courting is trying to capture is a purposeful relationship. You're engaging in a relationship as you stride up on your horse and you ask the father to pursue the woman, you know, and it's an honourable public thing, you know. And then as you enter into that relationship, it's clear and understood that I am courting you. And it's going somewhere. So whether you use the word, the word might be helpful. The word might actually help you clarify that this is not just dating in a more vague sense. This has got purpose to it. So if you want to use the word, use the word. If you want to dress in kind of, you know, puffy sleeves too, why not? You know, she might like that. But the idea behind courtship is spot on. This relationship is going somewhere. It's not saying we must get married if we start dating. It's not talking about it on the first date, but it's the trajectory you're on. Yeah? And you know how trajectories work, right? Slight variation over a long period of time, it goes somewhere. So at first it may not be something you're talking about all the time. It just may be in the background, you know? But over time it becomes more and more of an issue. In his book on dating, Josh Harris says, courtship is promising not to play games with one another's heart. And that's why, however quaint it might sound at first, the Christian view of dating as courtship is a beautiful, kind thing. It's promising not to play games with one another's heart. Dating, why date? It's for marriage, why date? It's in community. Dating is not a private, mysterious, intense affair. It's not something that should be restricted to a fun and magical thing built along enormous moonlit walks along beaches. It's not something that is no one else will understand. It's just us against the world. you know, in this kind of bubble of our song and our place and our gelato and so on. Now, some of that is brilliant and special and exciting, but if that's all it is, then it is actually can be quite dangerous and foolish, if that's all it is. For there is great wisdom and safety and kindness in warnings and protection and advice and counsel from other people. The perspective that others give you on yourself and on your partner. For relationships are always public things. Right relationships are. They're always a public thing, social thing in some sense. Or if they are private, it's for, you know, extremely exceptional reason. No, relationships in almost every situation are public, social things. They influence us and our behaviour and our time and our availability and our relationships and our networks. Your relationships are other people's business. They are. You as a Christian live for other people. You live in community. You're other people's business. And your relationships affect those around you. You care about them, and so your relationships have an impact on them. They care about you, so their thoughts and advice have an impact upon you. It's not none of your business. You're not thinking Christianly about community, about living in a network of family relationships. If you're saying, oh, that's none of your business, how dare you? You shouldn't stick your beak in. It's not your... Who are you to say, leave me alone? That's not a Christian way of thinking. Christian recognises other people, recognises we are put in community and relationship with others. You play sport. Who plays sport here? Hands up if you play sport. Shout out some of the sports you play. Netball? other basketball, soccer? Chess? Yeah. Perhaps except for chairs. Many, many sports involve the uniform. They involve practice agreements, they involve rules, they involve costs, they involve time schedules. Even if you're going to pursue it at a serious level, go to the AIS or something, they involve commitments to diet and lifestyle in a significant measure. And those things are your coach's business, those things are your teammates' business, those things, if you get serious enough, are even your fans' business. Or else you end up playing for Tassie Football League. You go to work. Hands up if you've got a part-time or casual job at the moment. Where are you working? Shout out some. Yeah? Yep. Yeah. You work. That involves often a uniform or a clothing standard. It involves other relationships, having to put up with other people, the rules about the sticky tape and the rules about the coffee urn. It involves the hours you work, when you can wake up, when you can leave, when you can take holidays, how you behave. Even how much you smile. I once got sacked from a job in Valhalla Ice Cream in St Kilda for not being smiley enough. It was during my punk rock phase. And so with relationships, it shapes how you dress, how you act, how you talk, how you live, how you spend your time. It has an impact on you and on others around you. It's a folly to only focus on your rights, on your privacy, on your uniqueness, on your... It's a folly in sport. It's a folly in work. It's a folly... in relationships, to only focus on your rights. There's a place to know your rights, yes, to protect yourself, yes. But if you only focus on them to the exclusion of your responsibilities, your public nature as a part of society, the fact that to some extent you are the same as everybody else, and at least for the proper functioning of anything valuable and significant, you have to fit in. I mean, even Metallica had to come up with a vision statement in the end. Have you seen Some Kind of Monster? Hysterically funny. But even the rebels in the end come up with some kind of manifesto, you know, of saying, you know, we're all individuals here. I'm not. Yes, you are. I'm not saying, and some churches do go nuts with this and do take control of every area of your life and every area of your dating life. And that's why I led with Nikki and my story, that there are exceptions. And it is, I'm not encouraging total control, big brother, except for churches and dating. There's room for opinion. In fact, there's even room to be foolish as a Christian. There's even room for you to be foolish as a Christian. We can't know each other's hearts. We don't know of every situation. And yet, I want to call on you to be wise, to trust parents, to trust pastors, to trust, to actually build mentor relationships. Invite people into your life to mentor and coach you and provide some discipleship to you. Invite that for your growth as a person, as a Christian, and for the significant... I mean, dating and marriage is up there alongside your career, right? And we seek out counsels and mentors and guidance and advice and decisions and plans and all this stuff because I want to end up being over here and doing that job. And we seek out all sorts of things here. You know, some of us are intense and we're doing business and we want to get a great job, and so we're following, you know, what, you know, the great business people do and what the practice of eye on that job and how am I going to get there. And as significant as your work, if not far more, is who you marry, because you're stuck with them until one of you dies or Jesus comes back. So get some counsel on that. Get some advice. Invite people into that decision. And you with the people who you came with tonight, you with your friends, your peers, your Christian friends, those of you who are Christians here, build relationships with each other that aren't simply mate relationships, kind of watch the footy or watch Gossip Girl relationships, that aren't just kind of hang relationships. Build Christian relationships where you... I mean, I arrived and there were a couple of girls praying on the other side of the... I think they were praying. Maybe they were playing, you know, sort of Angry Bird, but I think they were praying. And that's great, right? That you want to be praying with one another, for one another, opening the Bible together without some pastor telling you you have to, but because you're together seeking God's will, counselling, rebuking. Invite those friendships, yeah? We confess our sins, James says, to the Reverend one another. We confess our sins to each other. We don't need a pastor, a priest, a youth group leader. You are the pastors of one another. Pastor one another. This is an idiotic story, straight after the story of Solomon, his son. He had a son, Rehoboam. King Solomon, you got King David, king of Israel, then King Solomon. Rehoboam becomes king, and he's got people complaining, oh, we've been working so hard as we've been building the temple, and now we're worn out. Your father was really... put a lot of pressure on us, put a lot of stress on us. Well, come and have a look at the story in 1 Kings. Is it 1 Kings or is it 2 Kings? It's 1 Kings. Chapter 12 and verse 4. Chapter 12, verse 5. Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he puts on us, and we will serve you. So here's Rehoboam, this young king. There's this complaint coming to him. He goes, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon and said, how would you advise me to answer the people? He asked. They replied, if today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. Okay, so here's some wise advice. Care for the people, be smart, listen to your elders, and in the end, you're going to win out. Here's the advice of the elders. Then Rehoboam rejects the advice of the elders and gave him and consulted the young men who he'd grown up with and were serving him. He asked them, what's your advice? How should we answer these people, saying, lighten the yoke? And the young men who had grown up with him said, tell these people who have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Tell them, my little finger is thicker than my dad's waist. My father laid a heavy yoke. I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions. Things did not go well for Rehoboam. His kingdom splits in two. He blows it because he didn't listen to wise counsel. He was an idiot. Seek wise counsel. Seek wise friends, but not just the mates you grow up with, Rehoboam. Seek those older than you. Seek those who are boring, who give boring old advice. And involve them in your life, in your decisions, in your work decisions, in your dating decisions. Seek mentors. In his book on dating, Josh Harris lists three values of community, and I think they're terrific. The first is, dating and involving community in your dating gives you the reality check. The reality check. You're dating in community, and so you're seeing the other person in real life contexts. You're seeing the way they talk to their brothers and sisters, how when they're rude, when they chuck tanties, when they don't say, I love you, mum, you know, I don't trust anyone who can't say they love their mum. Come on, you know. When they're being selfish or self-absorbed or what, you see all those things. Or when they're being tender and loving and fun with their young siblings and willing to help out, and when they're thoughtful and kind and generous, you see all that. It's not childish to spend time with your parents when you're dating. It's not childish. Very good thing to do. Very adult thing to do, spending time with adults, no? A danger, especially in the giddiness and the wonder of romance, is to be blinded. And the gaps you don't know about someone, you fill in with what you like to think they're like. You know, no, he's really courageous. How do you know that? Well, I just like to think he's courageous. He looks courageous in that T-shirt. I love him in that T-shirt. So he looks courageous. But you don't know he's courageous. Have you ever seen him? So we fill in the gaps about what we like to think. But as we do things in community, we actually begin to see the person and see what our friends think of them as well and hear their thoughts on them as well. Secondly, the advantage of community, Josh Harris says, is protection. There's someone looking out for you in relationships. Often your boyfriend or your girlfriend might not be looking out for your best interests. Sadly, that can be the case. If you really know them, if you really love them, then you would know they're a sinner and they can't be trusted. If you really know them, if you're really close and intimate, oh, but you don't know him. Well, if you know him, you'll know that he's a sinner like everyone else and can't be trusted. And so dating in community recognises that, in a sense, you can't trust yourself solely to one person. Yeah? Except for the Lord Jesus. And so community protects you from manipulation, guilt, control, pressure, abuse. I mean, dads get this right. You know, if you're interested in her, talk to me first. And there's something, I just got a quote before I came here from Mark Driscoll in his sermon on dating, which I just thought was hysterically funny. And so I'll share with you. He says, if you want to date my daughter, then you've got to date me first. Get to know me. Bring me flowers. Actually, I like candy. We could go for long walks on the beach. If you want to date my daughter, date me first. We'll have heartfelt conversations. And if I approve, then you can get to know her. And if not, they'll never find your body. Now, as always, he's going over the top. But there is a sense in which inviting the protection of others is a really good thing. Yeah? And frightening, horny young men is also a very good thing. And there's nothing as frightening as a protective dad. Guys, invite this. Invite this kind of protection. Honour her dad or her brother or her pastor or youth group leader. Honour them and invite them to frighten the heck out of you. It doesn't have to be going around and, I wish to court your daughter. It could be that. That would be quite an honouring thing to do. But if you just couldn't come at that, then still inviting that in a way that would work. Yeah? And the third value of dating in community is accountability. The accountability to keep talking about marriage, to keep that on the agenda as the relationship progresses. The accountability to keep in a relationship in community rather than just in private. The accountability to keep godly in all the temptations that come into a relationship. The accountability to stop romance going out of control and becoming this intense, in-depth thing too soon, too early. We need that kind of accountability, reality check, some constraints on, because we, like all people, are sinners. And we, when captured with Song of Songs, speaks about love as being more powerful than the grave. It's something you don't want to arouse and awaken until it so desires. You've got to keep it in check. It's a powerful force. It's a good thing to have some accountability, some community, some support, some protection. It's a loving thing for you and for the person that you're dating. It doesn't need to be invasive. It can be supportive and serving and wonderful. And right through that romantic poem, the Song of Songs, there's the friends at once encouraging the relationship, at other times lamenting and urging, rebuking, celebrating. There's a place for that. A place for the friends, the good friends. Why date? For marriage, why a date? In community, why a date? For the gospel. That is why we live. Mark 8 that Nicole read. Let's open that up again and keep this in perspective. In dating, as in any other area, we do it if we are Christians. We do it if we have come to know the God who really is there, and if we come to live in the real world where God rules and where Christ not only lived and taught but died, not only died on the cross and was buried but rose again. The real world where these things happened in history. The real world where now we are in AD, the year of our Lord, when he reigns. And when he will return. At the turning point in Mark's gospel, halfway through, Jesus asks his disciples, who do people say I am? The whole first half of Mark's gospel, there's all sorts of people saying who they say he is. The disciples are going, I don't know who he is. Who the winds and the waves obey him? I don't know who he is. Who is this guy? Even the demons obey him. The only one who really gets it is the demons, in fact. As everyone's trying to make sense of who this guy is, a blasphemer, he's possessed, he's crazy, I don't know who he is. Everyone's asking who Jesus is. Who do people say I am? And the disciples, verse 28, reply, some say you're John the Baptist, some say you're Elijah, others say you're one of the prophets. But what about you? You've lived with me for 2.5 years, you've seen my teaching, you've seen my private life, you've watched the things I've done, who do you say I am? And his disciple Peter said, you are the Christ, you're God's King, you're the Saviour, you're God's way of saving the world. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone who he was. And at that point, when they finally get it, they finally see, this isn't just some amazing guy, this isn't just some prophet, this is the King who will save the world. At that point, he begins saying, now let me tell you my plan for world domination. I'm going to go to the capital city, I'm going to get beaten up, arrested, spat at, and killed. That's my plan. What do you reckon? Anyone? Anyone? Verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man, the way Jesus spoke of himself often, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Here we have Prince William, and he's coming up, and there's the king, and there's this thing, and it's love, and what's she wearing, and it's this great thing, going up to get married, and then maybe now he's going to become king. And so Queen Elizabeth died, and he's about to get throned as king, and stuff like this, and there he comes up, and there's a guillotine. What would the BBC commentators be saying at this point? Now, the steel of the guillotine has been made by the German steelmaker, and here's my plan as king, to die. They are shocked. They just can't compute this. Peter rebukes Jesus, verse 32. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But Jesus turned and looked at his disciples and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're speaking demonic things here. I must die. That's worldly, that's human, to think that I must not die. I must die. For it's his death on the cross that was the salvation of the world. It was his death on the cross where he took the sin of the world so that people guilty before God might be forgiven. And so then he calls on his disciples to follow the king who will die, to follow the king who will be crucified, to follow the Saviour who gave his life for the sinful world. You want to come after me? You today, uni fellowship. If you want to come after Jesus, verse 34, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the good news, the gospel, will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. You see, every aspect of your life now, if you want to live in the real world, you need to recognize Jesus is King. Jesus is the King who came to die. And so if you want to follow reality, the King who rules, then you need to die to yourself, follow him on the crucified path, living your life now for him and for his message of salvation. Every aspect of your life, your personal life, your career life, your financial life, your fantasy life, your dating life, your recreational life, your romantic life, all of it. Deny yourself, take up the cross and follow Christ, live for him and for the gospel. Because if you don't do that, you can gain everything, right? You can reach ultimate level in the world of Warcraft. You can have a mighty career as some executive or CEO, right? You can become the boss of your teachers, you know, and rule in some sort of administrative teaching post in a university. You can become happily married in a beautiful house with a Labrador and 2.5 kids, and you know, maybe you have a motorbike as well that you ride on the weekends to be dangerous. You can gain all things. You can visit hundreds of countries and always be on the move and have amazing experiences. And yet, if you don't follow Christ, if you're not living for Him, you've lost everything. You've lost your soul. You've gained nothing in the end. Christians who grow in their discipleship following Christ don't just have a Christian church life, youth group life, and then a worldly, ambitious study career life. Their study and career plans are following Christ crucified, living for the gospel. Christians don't have the kind of Christian friendship persona. It's a little bit nice, a little bit cute, doesn't know what a swear word is, and just kind of really loves indoor soccer, and then has this other non-Christian mate's life that's a little bit flirty, you know, a little bit crass, a little bit, oi boys, hey! And a little bit sort of a different person, so that it's actually embarrassing when the two mates collide. Which one do I be? Hey, hello, indoor soccer. You know, you don't know who you are. You don't know what to do. The person who's growing in the discipleship of Christ doesn't just have a nice Christian moral life on Christian moral things and then be swept up in a fantasy of romance that has no reference point to serving Christ. You are a Christian first. You're a Christian first before you're a best friend. You're a Christian first. If you follow Christ, you're a Christian first before you're a son or a daughter. You're a Christian first before you are going to be rich one day. You're a Christian first. And following Christ, He's King of all. Following Christ shapes the way we, our loves, our hopes, our fears, our hobbies, our studies. And so in dating, you see, do we agree on Christ? Is He Lord? And is He Lord crucified? And are we going to live our lives together, dying to self and following Him? Do we agree on who He is? And what it means to serve Him, and where we're going serving Him. Do we share those beliefs and values? Far more important than whether we both like that band. You're going on a great adventure together. It is a great, wonderful adventure together, serving the Lord Jesus. Together, dying to self and serving Him and living for His gospel and gaining all in Him. So go on that adventure together. And what if you're not going to get married? What if they're not, you don't want to? What if you haven't been doing it in community and they don't want to? And when you speak to friends or family or parents or pastors, they go, look, are you sure this relationship's a good idea? What if they don't share your heart for the gospel or they're Christian but aren't really on board with serving Christ with their lives? How do you end a relationship? How do you break up? Because dating is for marriage. Dating is in community. Dating is for the gospel. And so because of that, breaking up is actually a success. Breaking up is a good outcome. A ministry apprenticeship. Some people do a ministry apprenticeship and go on to become pastors. Others do a ministry apprenticeship, go on to be mums, or go on to be those who support and pay for and encourage ministry. All of them are a success. Because a ministry apprenticeship is about discovering your gifts and where you're going to serve God after it. You don't end up into full-time ministry, that's a success. You've figured out where you're going to be. You do go into full-time ministry, that's a success. Same with dating. Breaking up is a successful outcome. You've considered marriage. It doesn't look like it's a go. It's right to end the marriage, and that's painful and heartbreaking and difficult. But it's still an outcome. Dating is not a promise to be together forever. Going on a date with someone is not promising. Loving someone in a romantic relationship is not saying you will spend your life together. It's not a self-justifying thing. It's for marriage. Marriage is when you promise that, not when you have your song. That's not the promise that you'll always be together. You may hope for it, but you haven't promised it yet. How do you do it? How do you break up with someone? How do you end a relationship? Do not send a text message. Do not send an email. Do not send Facebook, and do not ever use Facebook email unless you don't have the person's email. Anyway, Do not cool off for ages and hope they'll get the idea. Do not cheat on them. Do not do it in a massively public place. Do not do it on their birthday. Do not do it on your anniversary. Do not do it right before you have to go to church. Do not do it right before their exams. But you do need to do it. You need to DTR, define the relationships. The same thing. You need to use words. You need to be gentle. First, I really want to talk to you about something important. You organise a time to meet. I really want to talk to you about something important. It's about the future of our relationship. You might even say, I've been thinking about where our relationship's going if they ask. We need to talk about something important. And then when you meet, you've got to be gentle, you've got to be kind. So something like, I've really enjoyed getting to know you, and I've appreciated the time and the kindness you've given me. I'm sorry, but I don't want to move forward with this relationship. Or I'm sorry, but I've decided to bring an end to our relationship. You need to say it. Hard words, very hard words. They are going to hurt the other person. I don't want to hurt them. You're going to hurt them to keep the relationship going if you want to end it. So they're hard words, but they're honest, and you're freeing them to move forward. What if they ask? Don't get stuck in a long discussion trying to convince or prove or lessen or make them feel better. You've broken their heart. You can't fix it. You might say something like, I just don't feel it's working. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason. It makes other people upset, but I think it's probably all right to say, look, it's not something about you. It really is about me. I know that's the cliche, but there's a reason why. We have different hopes, or our lives are going in different directions. Personal reasons I don't know how to put into words, but I'm sure that this is what I want to do. It's polite to give some brief reasons, but don't feel you need to justify yourself, fix the other person, bargain with the other person. I'll change, I'll be different, give me another chance. If you've decided, you need to stick by what you've decided. And then it's okay to leave, it's not merciful to leave it fairly brief. And when you've had that talk, then to say, I'm really sorry. Bye. And leave the person. And then it's got to be clean. It's got to be a break. Give them space. Separate out from some of the same social situations. Give them space. Don't keep checking in. Don't keep talking. Don't keep returning texts. It's got to finish. Avoid dragging it out. Avoid, as you're doing it, lots of physical contact. Be gentle, respectful, but a bit distant. And be clear. Not at the moment. Not a part of me will always love you. Not, please not, we can still be friends. That is a very painful and very confusing thing. Maybe one day, a long, long time from now, that will come back. But you've got to let that relationship die before you can rebuild another relationship again. Yeah? Be clear on what you think. If it's the right thing, stick to it. And what do you do when you date? Second big point. What do you do when you date? What's dating for? It's for marriage. It's in community. It's for the gospel. And if we're not going in that direction, the right loving thing to do, the good thing to do, is to break up. But we are dating, and it is going well, and it is for the gospel, and it is in marriage, and all that's happening. What do we do? How does dating look? I've got three bits of advice, and who knows when this is going to finish. Three bits of advice. The first is you get to know each other. The second is you get to love each other. And the third is you get your hands off each other. So we'll tackle each of those in turn as we finish up. First, you get to know each other. You're heading to marriage. Now's not the time to be married and to live together and arouse each other. Now is the time to get to know each other. Not staring in each other's eyes. You don't really get to know much about each other by just staring, except once you've gathered the fact their eyes are blue, good, you've done that. This is a purposeful friendship and fellowship leading to marriage. It's a purposeful friendship and fellowship. And so the big priority is to get to know them. Get to know each other in real life with friends and family and ministry activities as well, if you're Christians. Ask questions and listen. Listen carefully. Could even have a bit of a list to work out over the year or whatever, getting to know defining moments in their life, teachers they looked up to, what team they barrack for and when they last won the grand final, who heroes are, favourite songs, what they used to do as family, as kids, you know, were they camping family or, you know, what did they used to do? And fight. And disagree. That's part of getting to know someone. Uncovering the differences. Uncovering the things where you think differently, where your families were different, where your values are different. That's good. You learn a lot as you discover that not everyone thinks the way you do. You know, you learn a great deal. And you also get to know the other person and work out, are these differences defining differences and irresolvable? Are these that bring a creative tension? You know, that we're fascinated with those who are different to us, and that's part of the gel of romance. So find the time to fight and argue. It's not wrong, unchristian to argue, and it's not going to destroy the relationship to argue. It's going to strengthen it as you find the things you disagree on. Guys can struggle with this too, but girls, it's all right to have preferences and opinions and tell the guy you're dating what you like and don't like in terms of music or food or whatever. You know, you're allowed to do that. Yeah, you don't need to be ashamed about that. That's part of getting to know each other. But as you get to know each other, beware of going too deep too soon, getting tangled up together with massive, mega, epic conversations. You know, so the whole dating relationship of the first 3 weeks is just one huge, long conversation about everything with lots of me toos and wows, and I've never told anyone this before. Be careful about that because you're entangling quite quickly, aren't you, with the other person. You're getting emotionally quite deep. And make sure you look for the weaknesses in the person, not just the strengths. Probe a bit and uncover flaws and excuses and those things as well. You need to notice that, the excuses, the lack of self-awareness. You need to be aware of the other person in reality. And this is best done over time in community. It's a constant state, if you like, of DTR. You're constantly in a state of defining the relationship, clarifying who each other is and where you're going. And over time, you know, intense, the more you move towards a serious relationship, more towards you consider genuinely consider marriage, it becomes more intense. Slowly over time, build a defining who you are and where you're going and where we might be going. Get to know each other. Second, get to love each other. And this is talking about romance. I did a lot last time we did this dating stuff about how romance isn't the be-all and end-all. And I would hate for you to think, especially those who are like me when I was, you know, first dating Nikki, thought that somehow it was unchristian to be romantic and, you know, I'm far too holy for romance and I'm way too busy serving the Lord by sitting around in my share house thinking about serving the Lord, far too busy serving the Lord by reading lots of enormous books to possibly be able to be romantic. Heavens no. You know, I'm far too busy sort of joking around with my equally zealous Christian male mates about sort of random, stupid, silly stuff. But we're Christian mates and we're full on for Jesus, so that's fine. So I couldn't possibly be romantic and spend time with my girlfriend. Far too busy. I was an idiot. I was an idiot. I look back and I regret the fact that Nikki and I didn't even dance at our wedding reception because I was an idiot. Romance. I look at a guy I had a ministry apprenticeship with who did the whole total dessert on the top of Mount Wellington to propose to his wife. And I went, that is beautiful, isn't it? You know? And I wish I'd done that. Instead of kind of walking past Domino's in Sandy Bay. And romance is beautiful. And we've had lots of romantic times since. A turning point for us was a year into marriage. We went out to Marilla to have lunch. And that was even, gosh, are you allowed to spend money on dinner if you're full on for Jesus? That's the way I was when I was 22. And my dad had actually called ahead and paid for like a whole lunch. I think we were going to have cheese or something, weren't we? That was beautiful. And we've enjoyed many, many beautiful times since. written by my dad. dating is a strange thing. You're not just friends, but you're not lovers. You're kind of in this tripping sort of inception land between friends and lovers. It's a strange, but you are in a sense that there's the beginning of love and romance there, and you gotta go slow. You gotta not get messed up too quick, but Enjoy it. It's not just a friendship. Parents love that, don't they? He is Mikey's special friend. You know that thing? You're not just a special friend. I bet you I'll start doing that, right, when my kids start dating, and I'll hate myself for it. They're not just a sister in Christ that we're considering maybe getting married one day as we serve Jesus and so on. There's a romantic. You like it. She's pretty. She's really pretty. And you feel all tingly and you smile all the time you see her. And she's always touching her hair when she sees you. There's something there, right? Suddenly she's fascinated in surfing. She never, you know, suddenly she's sitting there for hours watching you surf, you know. Song of Songs is in the Bible. It's a book of romance, delight, feelings, longings, excitement, joy, pleasure. It's all a part of dating into marriage, and to sustain a healthy marriage, it's part of marriage. And sometimes it's unprovoked and spontaneous, but often it's not. It needs to be pursued and worked on. Married guys get together, Christian married guys get together at least, and rebuke one another for not working harder at being romantic. And go, no man, you've got to work on that. When was the last time you bought flowers? And so on. Because they recognize it's something important. It doesn't need to be epic. In fact, it often is the many, many small things. They're the many, many small gestures of romance. All of which, romance, we must see, all of which is an expression of Jesus' golden rule. Jesus says that the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbour as yourself. Yeah? And in Ephesians 5, talking about marriage, that command is applied to a husband loving his wife. He is to love his wife as he loves himself. An expression of obeying Jesus and being moral and loving others is loving your partner as you would like to be treated. And so it's actually part of the Christian moral life to love the other person. What does romance look like? I've got three things. See what you think of my definition. First is care and protection. Right, part of romance is a certain chivalry of care and protection. Is a certain nurturing of caring and looking after and pampering. It's all that kind of care and protection. So guys, if she's cold, give her the jumper. Oh no, but girls don't like wearing their boyfriend's hoodies, do they? No, that never happens, ever. If she's cold, give her your jumper. I don't know why she didn't bring a jumper. That's a mystery. Well, probably as a cue for you to give her your jumper, I guess. I don't know how it works. Maybe girls, that's one of the things they talk about in girls' bathrooms. If she's cold, give her a jumper. Help each other, serve each other, go out of your way for each other. When someone succeeds and they're really proud of themselves, celebrate with them. When someone's stressed, upset, anxious, comfort them. Not fix them, by the way. Now, guys, because we're kind of generally task-oriented, we hear, girl's got problem, I've got solution, done. Easy, backyard blitz, right, except for relationships. Guys need to learn to listen and go, oh, that's bad, oh, gosh, oh, why did that happen? And show that listening and understanding and sympathising is often more of a solution, right? Girls often see it as an opportunity to help the guy see that maybe it was partly because he, you know, he could have started the assignment earlier, actually. And maybe it's actually that, you know, I've been meaning to find a time to tell him he can be a bit brash with his brother. And so I'll point out to him that perhaps his brother has a point. He wants you on his side. Yeah, he's feeling sad and sulky and the spirits of darkness have descended. So it's more a case of going, oh, really? Oh, gosh. You know, it's a little bit of that. It's like the man cold, right? You know. In order to celebrate or sympathise, you've got to notice. You've got to be alert and attentive. Now, yeah, girls can work better at actually saying what they think instead of expecting guys to read minds, but guys, we are meant to read minds too. And we're meant to be attentive and to spend enough time not thinking about ourselves or the next task or project or whatever, to actually think about another person, notice their body language, notice what they actually said to us yesterday about being tired, and that maybe that tiredness could last for more than the 5 seconds it took them to say it. So maybe they're still tired 5 minutes later, and perhaps I should do something about that. Being attentive. Care and protection means cooking for other people, and food is delicious, isn't it? It means giving someone a permission to rest. And so there is a time for fixing, and sometimes, you know, girls, you need to let the guy fix it. And just send you to bed with a hot chocolate. You need to stop and just go to bed. I'm calling up youth group and saying you can't help tonight. It's loving your neighbour as yourself. It's going out of your way to care for the other. It's a hassle. It's a pain to love other people. But isn't that awesome? I get to go out of my way for another person. What a joy and a delight. It's not a hassle at all. It's also equally a challenge to let others go out of their way to care for me. Yeah? Let them care for you. Let them look after you and thank them that they do. Care and protection. Romance is also affection and delight. Affection and delight. You see, some people, their main way of appreciating romance is being looked after and cared for and protected. That's what they really value, you know, and it's as romantic for them for you to do something practical for them as it is for them to you to buy them roses. But most people want signs of affection too, not just service. Delighting in you. They like you. They enjoy seeing you. They value and cherish you. That's romance, affection. It's the little SMS and the email. It's the Facebook or the card. It's the flowers and the chocolates. It's gifts that say, I'm thinking of you. I like you. You're worth spending money on. It's touch as well. The hand on the shoulder, the holding hands. Now, different people have boundaries there. We'll get to that before we finish. But even if you there's not much body contact you feel comfortable with as you date for the sake of godliness, body language is a form of touch too, yeah? The smiles and the eye contact and perking up when you see someone. It's good to see you. You're back from the kitchen. It's good to see you again. That is also a part of showing affection. Romance is pursuing someone with thoughtful displays of affection. And it's putting in the energy and the effort to show that someone is special. You mustn't be too busy for this. You mustn't be too spiritual for this. You mustn't say, it's not my thing. I'm just not that kind of guy or girl. Well, if you want to date someone, you now are that kind of guy or girl. So love your neighbour. And thirdly, romance is admiration and honour. It's words that say thank you. It's words that describe what you would admire and respect about another person. It's words that say sorry and make peace. It's words that admit you can be wrong as well. And sometimes girls can struggle with that. You can sin too. And admitting that. And maybe I'm at fault here. Saying sorry. Admitting you can sin too. Words that invite wisdom and insight because I respect your advice, your wisdom. Blokes flourish under words of honour and blokes wither up under nagging and criticism. Girls blossom under words of esteem and cherishing, and girls die inside when they get mocked and belittled and talked over the top of. Admiration and honour is part of romance. And admiration and honour is shown in quality time as well. Whether it's dinners and movies and adventures and special things we do, or whether it's just watch me fix the car or watch me surf or come shopping with me. Because it says, not just I love you and you're awesome, but it says I like you and I enjoy your company and I just like being with you. A relationship cannot blossom just by having someone to do with who's always there and drag around after you while you go off doing your whatevers. A relationship is not just someone who can take you out on dates when you have dates. It takes effort and thought and time. And if you're not doing these things, if you're the opposite, if you're always putting the other person down, or you're in a relationship where the other person never takes any effort, is always putting you down, or playing guilt games with you, yeah? Saying it's your fault that I feel like this. You know, if the other person is worse, actually physically hurting you in some way. If the relationship is not heading in the way of the gospel, but is actually something that drains and discourages and makes you feel less of a person, then maybe the relationship's got to end. You've got to talk about it. You've got to define the relationship. And last of all, what do we do when we're dating? Well, we don't arouse one another sexually. Keep your hands off each other. Get to know each other. Yeah? Get to love each other, but keep your hands off each other. How far can we go? What's allowed? It's the wrong question. How far can we go in arousing one another sexually? No far is how far, because sex is enjoyed in marriage. Now, legalism and rules doesn't solve things. We can get around our rules. But some of the rules some people do is some people don't even kiss at all until they get married, and they find that a very helpful thing. A beautiful wedding day, huh? Some people say never time in private alone, always catching up in public, and if we're going around to each other's house and there's no one else home, nah, we can't do it. No sitting in bedrooms with doors basically closed. Setting the time limit. We're not hanging out at 9:30 at night and later and later. We're not in the car ever, just the two of us after dark. We're not hanging out for more than 2 hours in a row. We're, there's all sorts of different ways of setting some boundaries to respect one another, because until you're married, you could be dating someone else's bride. You could be dating someone else's husband. Yeah? How'd you feel? And it's the same if you're not dating. Marissa Cooper from the OC was constantly complaining that her boyfriend was jealous, too jealous, because it's perfectly reasonable for Marissa to spend all of her time having deep one-on-one conversations with other guy friends. Oh, we're just friends. Lay off, Ryan. We're just hanging out for hours and hours and hours, spending lots and lots of time together, and I'm the only person who can talk to him about these issues. Do not be Marissa Cooper. That's cheating on someone emotionally. That's dating someone in all but name. You enter into a relationship with someone, then that actually is restricting your relationships with other people of the opposite sex. It's changing your relationships with people of the opposite sex by dating someone. And if you're engaging in an intense relationship with someone of the opposite sex, you're flirting emotionally. Yeah? So these boundaries are needed, whether for those who are dating or those who claim they're not. Whatever principles we go for, however, get your hands off one another means accountability in community, means seeking challenge and questioning and insight from others. It means beware of the slippery slope. Once you break one of those rules once, it's easier to do it the next time. Once you begin arousing one another in a particular way, it's easier to go straight to that the next time. And it means defining the relationship in this area. If that top or that skirt drives you crazy, you're going to have to say something. If that particular massage is actually something that for you is more than just stress relief, you might need to say something. Define the relationship in this area. Love one another by respecting one another in godliness. And what if I failed? Let me close with this. What if I failed? God forgives. God's a God of forgiveness in this area. And if I've messed up in this area, I've gone too far, if I've blown it, if we as a dating relationship have blown it, God forgives. That's the gospel. God forgives. God can forgive our past sin. God can make us in his sight like a virgin again. We still need to deal with past sin, and we might need to deal with it in big ways. We definitely need to talk about past sin before we marry someone. But we are forgiven in God's sight, and God can overcome our mistakes in dating, just as he can overcome our mistakes in marriage. God forgives. What if I failed? Stop it. If you failed, don't fail again. Flee sexual immorality, the scriptures say. The gospel helps us say no to ungodliness. Get your hands off each other now. Stop it. If you're dating a non-Christian, you've got to stop it. If you're beginning to play with this kind of non-Christian way of living, so that when you're dating, you're actually living in an ungodly way and arousing one another, that's the path out of Christianity. You've got to stop it. Get your hands off each other now. It's not loving. It's not good. It's not innocent. It's mean and it's wrong. And God knows, and it's a big issue. Some of you here might be already going down that slippery slope. You've got to stop it. It's not Christian. We're not made Christian by being good. But as we're forgiven by Christ, he calls on us to live in a way that's good and right. Hey, it's not just sex. If I'm sulky, tantrumy, anger, if I'm selfish and ignoring, if I'm playing mind games, if I'm caging and never opening up, stop it. And if you can't stop, break up or get married. Both are excellent options that I strongly recommend. There is life after a relationship. A friend of mine, after being married for 18 months, his wife died just a couple of weeks ago, tragically, quickly. And there, as hard as it is for him, there is life for him after Barbara. There is life for him after marriage. And there is life for him after the death of his young bride. There is definitely life for you after breaking up with him or her. There is life after this relationship. This relationship is not this is not you. This is not what you need to be happy. There is life after a relationship. Breaking up's a good option. And you can get married while still at uni. Get married now. If the temptation's too strong, just get married. You get to have sex then. But seriously, marriage is beginning living life. And uni's life, isn't it? Marriage is beginning living life. Try to save up enough money to pay for the shopping, that's life. God looks after you. Nikki and I, most of our friends got married before we had really anything in the bank account and kind of made do, and God's been good to us and we learn a lot. Breaking up with him or her is an option. Getting married even while you're at uni is an option. But in all things, live for the gospel, including in romance and dating and all the joys and adventures and madness and mistakes. Live for the gospel. Let's pray. Our loving Father, we ask for your wisdom in applying this wisdom. Help us filter out what is wrong or unhelpful. Help us apply it in a way that itself is careful and correct. Help us listen to one another, forgive one another, and please keep reminding us of the gospel. The gospel is a message of forgiveness. The gospel is a message of hope for change. The gospel is what we live for and why we live. And please help us not ever lose sight of that in our struggles with sin or in our delights in romance. Amen.